The best pizza in here this weekend is the crop. Everybody else is on vacation at the retreat for this.
I didn't wear my Ezekiel t-shirt. Shame on me. If you didn't get or you don't have one of these Kings of Judah lists, would you make sure the notes from last week are back there? Makeup exams, you know. It's time to have makeup exams. We're going to have another probably tough final exam.
Really rough. That's the last one.
I've got a whole shelf of commentaries on Ezekiel, and most of them are awful. Academic and scholarly and uninteresting and argumentative. There are two commentaries that I like that are available. Ralph Alexander from Moody Press has this commentary from 1920 or some years ago. It's still in print, and it's still very, very good. And Amazon.com has that. And I found a good commentary from a man in England, Wales, Derek Thomas. His commentary that you can find that on Amazon.com or Christian Books. That's good. He's good. Otherwise, the most important thing is just for you to read Ezekiel in the clean pages back in the Old Testament there. And it's a marvelous, marvelous book. And last week we did three whole chapters. So if you weren't here, you'll want to rush home and read the first three chapters. The whole setting of this book is in Iraq. Our story starts in the hot summer. You know what the hot summer in Iraq is like now, 130 degrees in the shade, no shade. Our author, Ezekiel, is in an intern camp along with about 10,000 of his fellow countrymen, including Prince Jehoiakim, Kaniah, otherwise known as Kaniah, who's the legitimate heir to the throne of Israel. And he's been there for 5 years in this detention center. When Nebuchadnezzar raided a neighboring country, he'd run off with all of the elite, the brilliant high-tech, administrative elite leadership type people and take them first. He had already come in and plundered and taken Daniel and Daniel's friends some 8 years earlier and taken them off to Babylon. And now he comes in and takes Ezekiel and Kaniah and 10,000 of the top people in the country, top military leaders, top college professors, leading rabbis. Ezekiel, remember, is a priest. He's 25 years old when he's taken captive. Well, he was looking forward to a nice, comfortable career in Jerusalem, serving in the temple as a priest, and he would enter his priestly service at the age of 30. And now suddenly he's yanked out of his home and his comfortable family, and he and his wife are taken off to Iraq, to Babylon, and he's going to find that his career is not that of a priest, but a prophet. So this is interesting. All of the principal characters in this book are pretty young. They're not old Gandalf type priests that are stuffy and dull, because he's 25 years old, and we start hearing from him on his 30th birthday. Meanwhile, his friend Daniel, probably about the same age, is over in Babylon. Daniel probably was 16 or so when he went into Babylon. Both of them have been influenced by Jeremiah, who's maybe 20 years older, a good mentor for them, and Jeremiah gets to stay in Jerusalem 40 years. And which is a very thankless place for him to be. And he eventually even gets killed by his own countrymen after speaking to the last kings of Judah. Now Jeremiah would be about the same age as King Josiah. And King Josiah was killed in battle at the age of 39 after some years of wonderful reforms in the country. So that Josiah, King Josiah, would have been a very inspirational leader for Jeremiah. He and Jeremiah probably worked closely together. When Josiah was killed in battle, Jeremiah wrote a lament in his memory, which we don't have, but it's mentioned that it was in the Bible. So you can imagine the synergy in Jerusalem in these very turbulent days with King Josiah and Jeremiah being real spiritual leaders, and then these young men that got taken off to Babylon are now going to be God's spokesmen to the exiles. Therefore, you'll want to read 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel to see how these all fit together. It's the same general time period. And as I mentioned last time, what we'll do is we'll go leap right into Ezekiel, and then we'll do a few little flashbacks to get the historical setting. And if any of you would like to pick a topic from this time period, a biography or something of geography or history, and give a little speech, that's extra credit. We give gold stars for extra credit classes. Last week we found that, when he was 30 years old, in July 27th in the year 593 B.C., Ezekiel wandered outside of his little mud shack in Iraq and saw the heavens open and a great splendid vision of the glory of God. An absolutely awesome, difficult to describe picture of God revealing himself, along with four great angels and some marvelous wheels and a chariot throne, mobile and portable, accompanied by great noises and sounds and brilliant flashing colors and lightning. Beyond description. There's a special award in the class for artists who will come up with a good picture of this. Yeah. I've seen any. I've looked everywhere. On your top of your notes today, this is in color on my website, but William Blake, the mystic, tried to draw these cherubim in 1805, and that's about as good as I found anywhere. There's Jehovah up above, but he looks a little old and not very... a very depiction of the Almighty, good depiction. And there's a hint of wheels. But if somebody would draw this up, but that's a little facetious, because what's happened is that Ezekiel has had a direct experience with God which is very shattering and very upsetting. And this happened to Isaiah, it happened to Daniel, it happens to Habakkuk, it happened to Peter the Apostle. One of those times when God sort of jolts you with a direct experience with him that's overwhelming, shattering. If you've traveled to a foreign country, you know that when you come back home, you see yourself differently in the light of the foreign country. You see things about your own self that you wouldn't have seen if you hadn't gone overseas and seen others. Well, in a way, if God pulls you up out of your cultural ghetto, out of your comfortable church environment, and shows you himself as he really is, then it's very difficult for you to go back to the groupthink, the collective mentality, the herd mentality of the people you live with, right? Well, all of us here are spiritual and saintly and godly, and we're all doing wonderfully well, of course, and we don't have any flaws in us, and so God's happy with us, obviously. How would we know otherwise? Unless, of course, God decided to speak to us directly, or made us aware through changes in our life by disturbing the status quo, we might be forced to look at ourselves a little bit differently than we otherwise would have. And this is what's happened to Ezekiel. He's overwhelmed by this vision. For seven whole days, he's on the fringe of being a mental patient until he kind of comes to his senses. And God pulls him up on his feet and says, I have some work for you to do, and I'm sending you to a stubborn and rebellious people, and they're not going to listen to you, so I'm going to tell you ahead of time, they don't listen to me, so they won't listen to you. But I want you to speak to them, turns out, for the next 7 years, till Jerusalem falls. What they're going to find after all is said and done is they will realize that you were a prophet. That's about all. Jeremiah got less for his 40 years in Jerusalem. Nobody appreciated him. He had nothing to show for his ministry. Anybody who is a prophet like this is in danger of being, if he's not the real thing, then he's a kook and a nut and deceitful and harmful. And there were people like that. So in Babylon, there were false teachers running around. I gave you today a letter excerpted from the book of Jeremiah, in which Jeremiah writes a letter to the exiles over in Babylon and warns them about these false teachers that are running, teaching contrary to what Jeremiah has been told to teach and what Ezekiel and Daniel were teaching. They were genuine prophets of God. So it's very dangerous to be a false prophet and to mislead the people. Ezekiel has a calling. He is called to be a watchman on the walls, and then he's given some strange instructions. These very strange instructions. God says to him, I want you to shut your mouth until I tell you to speak. I don't want any casual conversations in the patio. I don't want you to have any discussions outside of your own family circle in which you speculate about politics or religion or theology. You shut up until I tell you to speak. And when I speak, you go out in front of your house and speak. Well, that's 7 years of that. That's pretty tough. I think particularly for us Americans, because we're garrulous and we like to talk and enjoy one another. And fellowship is something we all value. Well, he didn't have that privilege. He had his wife. I'm sure that when he was home, he could eat well. And he could talk to his wife freely and any of the family members. But out in public, a very strange public ministry. Well, we saw all that last week about the man. And that brings us up to chapter 4, which is where we want to start. You also, God's still talking to Ezekiel and giving him instructions. You also, son of man, take a clay tablet. I want you to go out in front of your house, and I want you to take some of that wet building clay that all the buildings in Babylon are made out of. And I make this big clay tablet. It could be, I don't know, maybe as big as a yard or a square foot. And I want you to build a model on it of the city of Jerusalem. I want you to draw a scale model. You could use Yahoo Maps or Maps on Us if you want to get out an atlas. But everybody knew what Jerusalem looked like. So draw a picture of Jerusalem. Now I want you to depict in this model. I want you to pick Jerusalem under siege. Jerusalem was not at that time under siege. It would come under siege 6-7 years later, and it would be under siege for 18 months. And while it was under siege by Nebuchadnezzar, before it fell, conditions inside the city would be horrendously bad. And people sitting here in Babylon are quite sure they're going to get to go back to Jerusalem any time now, that they get to go back and live happily ever after. And God has to convince them that no, Jerusalem is going to be in ruins, and you ain't never going back there. You're going to stay here in Babylon for 70 years, and your kids get to go back there down the road. Well, anyway, lay a siege wall against it, keep up a mound against it, set camps against it, and place battering rams against it. Ancient method of warfare. With a walled city, you approach the walled city with battering rams and siege towers that you can reach up over the wall with. Now, take an iron plate, Ezekiel, and set it as an iron wall between you and the city. Now, lay down and make this slab, then put a piece of iron, maybe an old skillet or baking tin or something, between you and the city. What do you suppose that would symbolize? An iron wall. Yeah, Ezekiel's acting out this siege. And there's an iron wall between him and Jerusalem.
Hard-headed,
yes. God's turned his face against you people. God's ignoring you. God is relentless in his pursuit of justice. So this is pretty serious. Make yourself an iron plate and set it as an iron wall between you and the city. Set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you will lay siege against it. That is, you can bring up your camels and foot soldiers and your little toy men, and you can put armies around this city, and people can come and watch you doing this, but you're not going to talk to them. You're going to just act this out. And we'll have the sermons a little later, but you're going to do this for quite a period of time. As a matter of fact, this is going to go on for 430 days, day after day after day. So every day he gets up out of bed and has a big breakfast of ham and eggs home and... No, has a big breakfast of Wheaties or granola and goes outside his house and runs through this siege thing. And 430 years is how long the Jews were in Egypt and bondage, and that probably was running in the back of the minds of people who sit and watch this crazy nut out building this siege model. Now, here you are. This is a sign to the house of Israel. I want people to think very deeply about what it is you're doing here in this model of Jerusalem. Lay on your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. Let the sin of Israel be upon you while you're laying on the left side according to the number of days that you lie on your side. You will carry their iniquity. I have laid on you the years of their iniquity according to the number of the days, 390 days. I want you to lay on your left side for 390 days, and during that time, symbolically, you're carrying all the sins of the 10 northern tribes of Israel. Okay. How about that laying the iniquity upon? Jesus. We talked about Ezekiel being a type of Christ, being an example of Christ as our sin bearer. There it is, right there. Then after that, after you've been on your left side for 390 days, I want you to lay on your right side for 40 days, which corresponds symbolically with the amount of time the two southern tribes are guilty of sin, one day for every year. You shall set your face toward the siege of Jerusalem. Your arm will be uncovered. Arm will be uncovered, that would symbolize God's ready to act. You will prophesy against it, and surely I will constrain you so that you cannot turn from one side to another until you've ended the days of your siege. If necessary, I'll tie you down with ropes. Now, this is all day long. It isn't at nighttime, probably. It's day after day, and it's probably in the hot sun. I hope there was a little shade there out a palm tree or something. This little region is outside the city of Babylon, and it's the place where the Tigris and Euphrates are fairly close together with canals. Give you a map of old Iraq and modern Iraq, which there's some last week's notes are over there if you didn't get them. Now, it's a little unsure what this 430 days is all about. It's a little hard to make sure what that's all about. Chuck Missler speculates that this is a prediction of events yet to happen in the future in this 430 days, because Leviticus, God said he would multiply the iniquity of Israel by seven times. So if you take that seven times and multiply it out a lot, you can get two dates out of this. One would be May 1948, when Israel became a state, and the other would be June 1967, when Jerusalem was reunited again. And that's a little speculative, so I didn't make 80 copies of that. I made 10, and if you want to read that, you can come up here and get copies of that crazy idea, but it may be true. I don't know. Incidentally, the cassette tapes go over to the bookstore at, what, $3.50? Are they $3.50 now?
$3.
$3 even? $3. And then man here with the iPod recording this live, and by 2 o'clock this afternoon, that'll be on the website if you want to go home and listen to it in disbelief what's going on here. Now, Ezekiel, you've got this more than a year of plain hard work day after day after day, and keep your mouth shut and do as I tell you, and if necessary, I'll tie you down. But now let's talk about your diet. First time. Take for yourself wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. Put them in a vessel and make bread of them. And during the number of days, you may have this bread. Your food, which you eat, will be by weight 20 shekels a day. That's about 8 ounces. So during the daytime, you get to make yourself a nice bread, a piece of bread outside, and you can eat that. And that doesn't mean you can't eat when he gets home in the evening. Probably could. Obviously, this isn't very much bread. And he also gets water, but not very much, about a quart or so. A quart of water in the hot desert is not nearly enough.
Back on the first 8 verses, did you cover why the Lord had him lie on one side for so long and then on the other side for so long? I mean, what was the point of all that?
The point was to show that God was dealing with the 10 northern tribes in perfect justice for their years of disobedience to him. And in the case of the 10 northern tribes, God had on his calendar 390 days they owed him. Days of years. Then, on his other side, he had 40 days of years in which he was displeased with Judah's behavior. Now, that's a little fuzzy as to, but the dates are about right. If you take those as, it's pretty hard to get the start date, the end date, but that's about the right overall time period in which Israel had been under the kings. If you find anything in the commentaries that's really definitive on this, all the commentators sort of fuss a little bit about this. It's pretty hard to pin this right down. But you see what's going on? God's saying, you owe me big time, and I'm gonna get my payback time now. Israel is, the northern tribes are far more guilty and far more disobedient, and they owe me much more. They've been living in my land without paying rent, essentially, without paying attention to the laws of the land, so now this is payback time. And Judah, the southern tribes, haven't been as bad, but they've been bad. They owe me 40 days. Times, 40 years. 40 years. accumulated. All of this would be in the details of Deuteronomy and Leviticus. What is specified back in Deuteronomy, the terms for living in the land. The right of the Jews to live in the land is conditional on their obedience. Land belongs to them forever. Tail end of Deuteronomy says, if you behave yourselves, you can live in the land and I'll prosper you and bless you. But if you don't behave yourselves, I'm going to throw you out and I'm going to extract the rent that you haven't paid me spiritually. And the land vomits out its inhabitants. This is God's land. This is no ordinary piece of land. You just don't live there with impunity. It's a dangerous place to be because God put his ownership on that land. And anybody who lives there has to be godly. This is God's representative nation. Now, there's another factor in here that we always gotta do some interpreting as we go through this. Israel, the nation, had a covenant relationship with God. The whole nation was in a covenant relationship with God. God had made a set of promises to them, and he had expected a response from them, and this is a two-way agreement. And God's simply holding them to this agreement, this covenant. The United States does not have a covenant with God. We can't go to God as a nation. The church, however, has a covenant with God. It's a different covenant. It's not the same covenant, but it's still a covenant in which God initiates and the people respond. It's a bride-bridegroom covenant. Israel is the unfaithful wife. God's saying, okay, time's up. We've had 900 years of a bad marriage. I've got to do some actions to get your attention. And this whole book about Ezekiel is God getting your attention to his wife, because nothing else has worked. His kindness hasn't worked. His patience hasn't worked. So he gives big time.
390,
that means Israel had more sins. What's the relationship between 390 and 40? Why? So just to Judah has less sins than Israel. Yeah, we'll look in a minute. If we get time, we'll go quickly to that
king's
list.
Isn't the laying on his side inactivity symbolic of the Sabbath that they cheated God out of?
Yeah, you cheated God out of the Sabbath because you're supposed to give the land rest every 70 years and you haven't done that, so I'm going to force the land to rest by taking you out of it, and I'm going to collect the rest that you owe me. So yes, Ezekiel rests for all that time on his side, but the iniquity of the sins of the people is laid on him symbolically, because he's the sin bearer. Okay? It's a little mystical. Now, the hardest part in Ezekiel is going to be, how in the world does this fit in with our lives? How in the world? This seems so strange to us. And we have to think of a different covenant, different set of conditions, different place in history. We're not in the same place in the different circumstances. Same God. The thing about this book is we're dealing with the very same God. So he doesn't get much to eat, and he only gets a quart of water, and you probably need a gallon of water out there. So when he gets home at night, he's very thirsty, and he runs right in and has a lot of iced tea or lemonade or something. Now, you shall eat your barley cakes, and I want you to bake your barley cake on human dung. Human waste, which is pretty repugnant to the Jews or anybody else. Not specific in the law of Moses, except human waste was to be buried always or removed. In many parts of the world, however, to this very day, animal dung from a water buffalo or camel is dried and used for fuel. I remember when Ted Wise and I went to India one night in Delhi, New Delhi, we were in Delhi at late afternoon, and the air has got this greasy, smoggy smoke that gets all over you and you go have a shower. Well, that's because all the dinners are being cooked on cattle dung that evening and it's just everywhere. It's not considered really bad, but obviously not our taste.
There was a program on TV last night and it indicated how the
marsh area.
It's the marsh area, and it was on that, how they speculated that that may have been the Garden of Eden.
The marsh Arabs, when Saddam Hussein, one of the bad things he did was shut off all the water canals that flowed into that area and darn near exterminated them. And now when the U.S. came in, we reopened those canals to restore that marshland that's down where right near where the Tigris and Euphrates come together and go into the ocean. Now, Ezekiel protests cooking this barley cake on human waste, and God says, okay, all right, no big deal. Ezekiel says, I have never defiled myself from my youth. I've never eaten what was died of itself or was torn by beasts. nor has abominable flesh ever come into my mouth. I've been an observant Jew, a good priest. I've been preparing for the temple service. And so God said, okay, I'm giving you cow dung instead of human waste. Cook your bread on it. Now, symbolic meaning, surely, he said to me, I'm going to cut off from Jerusalem the supply of bread. They shall eat bread by weight and with anxiety. Then they're going to run out of bread. And they shall drink water by measure and with dread. The siege of Jerusalem, when it happens, is going to be 18 months. It's yet future, some years ahead of time. But when it happens, the people are going to run out of bread and water. And in fact, we know that from Josephus and from history, that that's indeed exactly what happened. It is even worse than that. As a matter of fact, they're going to resort to cannibalism. They're going to starve to death. Lots of them will starve to death. This is an absolutely terrible tragedy. Lots of about 1 million people die in the siege of Jerusalem. God's people. It's even worse in AD 70 when God comes in with it on the same day of the year, on the 9th of Av in the year AD 70. And Titus destroys Jerusalem in a long siege, same sort of scenario. Horrifying. Josephus records it.
I noticed it said, in their sight, in verse 12. So he's doing all this for them to see, to pass by.
Pass by, yes. This is out in out on his front lawn. Only he didn't probably have a front lawn. He had a date palm. And he was lucky. So he's going to do this model, and all these 10,000 people wandering around in the detention camp are going to come out every day and say, what in the world is going on here with this guy who won't say a word, doesn't answer our questions, and does this for 430 days.
Yeah. What do you think God's trying to do by this demo here for those people wandering by? You think they can catch on?
No.
No?
Okay. How would God negotiate the choice of fuel between the death and the people? I mean, why would they kind of say, in exchange and do this? Okay, well, I don't want to. Well, then, okay, do this other thing.
Well, I think that's God's being gracious to the man. Conditions in Jerusalem are going to be so terrible that there'll be no vivid imagery that you could possibly portray in a diagram that's going to be the horror of Jerusalem. But the people are going to think about this all their lives. And when Jerusalem is finally destroyed, years down the line, 7 years down the line, they will look back and say, oh ho, now we understand what that crazy Ezekiel was doing out in front of his house for 430 days. Okay, next, yeah.
Is there also an analogy to the scapegoat, that is the iniquity to place on the scapegoat's
yes.
head and then left to go into the wilderness?
Yes, because Ezekiel is like that scapegoat, and the remnant is like the scapegoat. You survivors out here in Babylon are the lucky ones. You've avoided the destruction of Jerusalem, and your sin bearer is carrying the sins away, yes. Now, the next chapter is interesting also. Next week, we start getting into some of the spoken messages, but here, these are two stage plays here. Chapter 5. Near the time of this 430 days, he's getting a little tired of laying on his side, and he goes home inside his house and marks up X on the wall, or mark on the wall, because he knows the exact time. And he and his wife are counting when it's going to run out. Now God says, okay, next assignment. You've got a long beard, you've got nice long hair. Son of man, take a sharp sword, like a barber's razor, and pass it over your head and your beard, and take all of your hair off of your head, bald. Take all of your beard and put it in a big pile of hair. And he probably had a lot of long hair and a lot of big beard, goes in a big pile. And this is a sign of humiliation and repentance. To a Jewish priest, to a Jewish rabbi, to have long hair and long beard is a nice picture of manhood. And he's going to run around. He's probably going to walk through the streets of town and shave in front of everybody with a sharp sword. Shave totally bald. No reason to do that at all, ordinarily. And yet that God says, you're going to be bald, and I want you to carry this big bunch of hair around with you. And then that gets interesting. Weigh it on the balances. Put it on a balance and weigh it in shekels, whatever it is. You shall burn with fire 1/3 of this pile of hair in the midst of the city. Go back to your little clay model of the city. Take 1/3 of the hair from your beard and put it down in the city and burn it up. when the days of siege are finished, that is when you're at the end of your 430 days, I want you to take this hair from your head, one third of it, and burn it up in the city. And then I want you to take one third and strike it with a sword, openly, publicly, and cut it all up. And then I want you to take the other third and scatter it to the wind. And then I want you to take just a few small hairs in your pinch of little hairs and tuck them into your belt. Symbolism? That's pretty terrible. A third of the people of Israel are going to die in the fire and the destruction of Jerusalem. Another third are going to die in the warfare of Nebuchadnezzar as he comes in and eradicates the Jews everywhere in the land. And then a third are going to flee to foreign countries. And then there's going to be a little handful that will be safe under the in Ezekiel's belt, except that you will also take a small number of them and bind them in the edge of your garment and take some of those remaining pieces of beard and throw them into the middle of the fire and burn them. Even the remnant is going to be tested and tried. And now this is devastating. This is absolutely terrifying. Thus says the Lord God. Now we get one of those many times in the book where we have thus says the Lord. This is Jerusalem. I have set her in the midst of the nations and the countries all around her. Jerusalem is the model city. Israel is my model nation. I want all the nations in the world to look at Israel and see this is what God's like. This is what God's people are like. This is how all other nations should govern themselves. This is what it looks like when you have God dwelling in the middle of a people. This is why God made Israel a special people.
Why would he ask him to do that? Did Jews understand the implication of all this?
Well, they said they did. They said they did. There's that old little proverb, how odd of God to choose the Jews. How odd of God. Arbitrary. God, the Old Testament says he didn't choose them because of their giftedness or there were any special people. He chose them arbitrarily, elected them to be a representative. Highest honor you could give anybody.
What's amazing about this is it's a really good example of Ezekiel's obedience to God in front of the disobedient.
So here this is the one man in out of these 10,000 that's doing what God tells him, that gets up in the morning and does what God tells him to do, and he's not very popular. And you got people laughing and cursing and spitting at him and thinking he's nutty, and they can't get at him at all. Now, after Jerusalem falls, there's a radical change in Ezekiel's ministry. He gets to do some pretty deep things later on. So you want to hang in for this. Now, here's what God says about Jerusalem. And now Ezekiel gets to talk. He says, go tell the people the following. I have set Israel, Jerusalem, in the midst of the nations and the countries around her. She has rebelled against my judgments by doing wickedness more than the nations. Boy, that's a terrible indictment. God's people have actually had worse behavior than the pagans. We're going to get more of that in Ezekiel. That's just unthinkable. Until you start thinking about hypocrisy and self-righteousness and pride and arrogance and the sins of the spirit and our haughtiness and all those things, until you start thinking about maybe we're not as good as we think we are. And this is 900 years, not 5 years. Not only that, but they have refused my judgments. They've not let me evaluate their lives. They've not let me correct them. They've not let me move them in different directions. They've not walked in my statutes, ignored my law, not paid attention to the law of Moses. Therefore, consequence engines, thus says the Lord God, because you have multiplied disobedience more than the nations that are all around you, over 900 years since you left Egypt, and you've not walked in my statutes, nor kept my judgments, nor even done according to the judgments of the nations that are all around you, if your behavior had only been as good as some of these pagan nations, that could let you off a little easier. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, indeed I am against you, and I will execute judgment in your midst in the sight of the nations. And I will do among you what I have never done before, and the likes of which I will never do again because of all your abominations. Abominations, a word that belongs in our dictionary of Christianese. Abomination means behavior that is morally repugnant to God, that he finds offensive, that is deeply repulsive to him. That's what that means. You think about the behavior that God is deeply offended by as a person.
This is going to happen shortly, right?
Yeah, 7 years.
Uh-huh. Well, what about during the tribulation period? Is it going to be worse than this?
Yes, it is. It is. It's in AD 70, it's going to happen again, and at the end of the age we live in now, it's going to happen again and be worse still. You don't learn the lesson of history, condemned to relive it? Okay. Let's see here what happens now. Verse 10. Therefore your fathers will eat their sons in your midst, and your sons will eat their fathers. That's the cannibalism that's documented now by Josephus. It actually happened. People starve to death and begin to eat the deceased, even kill their infants. That's how bad the famine gets to be. That's how terrible, unspeakably terrible it is going to be in Jerusalem. And as a matter of fact, this Deuteronomy, it spells this out. This could happen to you guys. Don't pay attention to God. This is the sort of thing. It's all predicted. It's all working out exactly according to what it says in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And those of you who remain, I will scatter to all the winds. I'm going to take all the Jews out of Jerusalem for 70 years. AD 70, I'm going to take all the Jews out of Israel for 2,000 years. Covenant of the land, this land. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord God, surely because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things and with all your abominations, therefore I will diminish you. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. When judgment starts, it's ruthless and unstoppable and thorough, and that's both comforting and scary. God delays judgment as long as he can. He prefers mercy, always. He prefers grace and mercy. He does judge because he's just by nature. And then there's this thing about defiling the sanctuary. Well, now that's the temple of Jerusalem, but for us, body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. So that impinges on our thought life and our behavior and our walk with God and our separation from the world would be, this is how you apply this to our life. One third of you will die of the pestilence in Jerusalem and be consumed in the famine in Jerusalem. One third will fall by the sword, and a third will be scattered, and I'm going to pursue the people who are scattered with the sword. Armies of Nebuchadnezzar and others. Already at this time in history, the land of Israel's already had a number of pretty bad invasions and destruction of a number of cities. Thus shall my anger be spent, and I will cause my fury to rest upon them. And I will be avenged, and they shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken it in my zeal when I have spent my fury upon them. Moreover, I will make you a waste and a reproach among the nations that all are around you, all the nations around you, in the sight of all who pass by. So it shall be a reproach, a taunt, a lesson, an astonishment to the nations that are all around you. What's going to get around the news? In the evening news, look what happened to Jerusalem. Look what happened to God's people. Look what happened to that beautiful city. Why it's been laid waste and ruined. Why, what in the world is going on over there? Why, those Jews, those no good Jews. They'll be mocked and laughed at. What do you think of the current leadership of Jerusalem right now today, the current leadership of Israel? Do you think these are fine, honorable, God-fearing men? No. If they were, do you think things would be a little less turbulent over there? Yes. Will the Jews eventually get there? Yes, they will. We had that in Romans, that eventually God's going to get Israel to be the model nation he wants them to be, because Jesus is the true Israel, and Jesus single-handedly is able to do that. Hadn't happened yet, though. And here we're looking at a book that's 2,700 years old. People don't learn very quick. So it shall. Jerusalem will be a reproach, a taunt, a lesson, an astonishment, when I execute judgments in you in anger and fury and furious rebukes. I, the Lord, have spoken. Equivalent for us, the time has come for judgment to begin with a household of faith. If judgment begins with us, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel? If the righteous man is only saved with difficulty, where will the sinner and ungodly appear? Which means that if God decides it's time to judge America, and maybe be past overdue, he starts by judging his covenant people in this country. That's us. If we judge ourselves, we would not be judged. If you're close to God, you're doing fine. If you're not paying attention to God, just wake up call. God loves you. Doesn't change any of that. But it's just this side of God that we'd rather not bother to look at. This anger, furious rebukes, strong, tough love. When I send against them the terrible arrows of famine, which shall be for their destruction, and when I send to destroy you, I will increase the famines upon you, and I'll cut off your supply of bread. So I will send against you famine and wild beasts, and they will bereave you. Pestilence and blood shall pass through you, and I will bring the sword against you. I, the Lord, have spoken. Inevitable. Can't get out of this now. No amount of promises are going to get God to not do this. Relentless. Sounds pretty heavy duty, doesn't it? God of love, God who is just.
Now, what about the latter part of verse 9?
Mm-hmm.
He says, I will never do it again. Well, he is going to do it again. He's going to do it at least two more times. What does that mean?
I think it probably means in the same way, but in the same exact way. I don't know. That's a good question. When Jesus spoke about this in Matthew 24 in the Olivet Discourse, he says that the things that are going to come upon Jerusalem will be more terrible than they've ever been through before, and will never happen again. It's the same kind of language that Jesus uses, only it's intensified.
And the same with the flood, right?
And with the flood, yeah, I'll never again bring a flood. And then I'll never judge the world by the flood of water, but I will judge the world in a different way. Yeah.
In the back of this judgment is his love, and if they repent, they will be forgiven. But the next time they backslide, it's going to be even harder. And maybe that's what he means. The next time you backslide, it's even going to be harder. Although I will forgive you if you repent.
What do you get when you've got maybe a son or a daughter that you patiently teach and who ignores you and disobeys you? What do you do? When you're patient and you teach. And what's the result of not responding to correction and not listening to love? Get insensitive and hard-hearted? What does a parent do when you've got a rebellious kid that won't shape up after 5 years? Do you tighten the screws a little bit? The love gets a little tougher and a little stronger, and you turn up the consequences. And you pray more, and you agonize more, and it hurts the parent more than the kid, and you agonize because this kid is destroying himself or herself, and eventually you get ruthless. Let the kid go to jail. Can't live here if you're not going to live by the rules of our household. You're going to have to go pay your own bills right now. Don't we see that? What do you do? What does a God of love do to get people to respond? When the gentle approach and the patient approach doesn't work. Well, do what you want to do, yeah.
This is a wild speculation, but do you think that the Holocaust might be an extension of this kind of
thing? Yes, it certainly is, because the Holocaust, terrible as it was, God's still treating the Jews as his covenant people, whether they're aware of it or not, and they're still held to very, very tight standards. The history of the Jews, down in the last 2,000 years, very, very interesting reading. If you go get a book on the history of the Jews and how they have been badly treated in Spain and Russia and England and various lands, it's a horrible story of persecution and suffering and forced conversions, and yet they cling together and survive. I think it's in Ezekiel where Jesus says he'll be a little synagogue to them. He will protect them nevertheless, even when they're scattered. And they have survived. So this is an incredible story, because with covenant love, God never gives up. He could have just said, okay, I'm through with you guys. This is the end. We're getting a divorce. Hosea?
But he also promises, let's see, that those who persecute them will not go unpunished.
Oh, yes. Now we've got a lot of peripheral things to talk about here in Ezekiel 2, with regard to how and why and the mechanics by which God does that, because God is using Nebuchadnezzar as what he calls the rod of his anger to chasten Israel. And when God is through with Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar gets the axe. And this is always true with the enemies of Israel, that they become God's instruments to correct, to chastise his people. And then after that, these bad guys are judged severely too, in God's justice. Now, we've got this so far a little bit out of context. So that's why I wanted you to all take a little look at this chart. Just, I'm sure all of you are very conversant in the whole history of the Old Testament, and if not, you will get there this week by going back and reading all this, because this is really, really fascinating. My whole Bible class, we've been studying the life of David for a while now. We're in Solomon's life. These kings are wonderful character studies. All the kings. Ray Stedman was always, one of the things I've always remembered about his teaching was that his teaching that every one of you is a king over the kingdom of your life. Every one of you has a sphere of influence. Every one of you has turf, territory. Everyone is a king. You're all royal sons and daughters. To the extent that you subject yourself to the King of Kings, you will be given dominion. To the extent that you rebel against the King of Kings, you will lose dominion. Sound reasonable? You have a king. You're an important person. You have a big sphere of influence. Yield yourself to the King of Kings. Follow the principles of the king, and you will always be led in triumph and be blessed and be prospered, and your influence will be lasting. That's for us, okay? Now then, we look at the track record of the kings of Israel, which is here. So you have to kind of go back and look at the whole history here. God brought the Jews out of Egypt about 1500 B.C., 1400 B.C., brought them out under Moses. First generation did really wonderfully well. No. Died in the wilderness, came to the edge of the land, and they wouldn't enter in, and so God said, okay, doors closed. The next generation will enter into the land. At Mount Sinai, when they got the law, and Moses was gone up on the mountain a little bit too long, they had a big party and got into the worship of the golden calf right away, and Moses said, here's what God wants you to do, and the people said, all that God commanded we will do, and then they proceeded to go do the opposite, right from the start. And then so the next generation, after 40 years in the wilderness, Joshua brought them into the land, and they conquered the Canaanites, sort of, in complete obedience, but not what God wanted out of them. And they divided the land up among the tribes. It was their land. They had a right to divide it up and live there in peace and harmony together. And all went well until Joshua died. Then they all said, well, we'll pitch together, and we'll have a wonderful, nice, democratic way of life. We'll get along with each other, and we'll all be happy because we've learned from Moses and Joshua exactly how to live. We've got the Bible now, the five books of Moses, so they lived happily ever after. No, they didn't. We get to the book of Judges, and we find this period of maybe 400 years in which every man did what was right in his own eyes, and they were all factioned and divided. And they were at odds with each other, and their enemies came in and took advantage of them, and they were an example, a big zero of a nation. And then Samuel came along, and the first of the prophets, and the last of the judges, and Samuel's a great leader, so he sort of rallies people together. And then the people say, you know, we'd do a lot better if we had a king. And Samuel was a little heartbroken. Samuel's two sons weren't pretty good guys, so when Samuel died, they wouldn't have been good successors. So the people said, well, you know, we really need a king over us. And Samuel said, oh, you guys, don't you ever learn. Okay, I'll go ask God that you can have a king, but you're going to be very sorry that you had a king, because kings tend to be rather corrupt. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and these kings will tax you, and they'll multiply horses, and they'll have big banquets, and they will be cruel and oppressive, and they'll forget that they're supposed to be shepherds over you, and you'd be better off if you had God as your king. Can't you have an invisible king? Well, we don't like invisible kings very well. And yet, Samuel knew his Bible well, and he looked back in Deuteronomy, and there in Deuteronomy, God had anticipated this, and he said, okay, there's going to come a time when the people want a king, and you can have a king if you want to, and if you want a king, then here's what the king's supposed to do. What's the king supposed to do? Supposed to copy his own copy of the Bible, by books of Moses. Supposed to read it every day. Supposed to obey it to the very letter meticulously. Supposed to be a man of prayer and self-examination, and he's supposed to live by this book. Okay, we get the first king, Saul. 40 years, first king. Good military man, good family man, awesome king. Terrible, disobedient, failed a major test, disqualified. So God says, well, I'll put David in as king. And David, of course, and Saul got along wonderfully well. They became instant friends, stayed friends, and Saul was a good mentor. No, wrong. Saul's anger and bitter tried to kill David, the young David, for some years. David, the shepherd, was a man after God's own heart. And finally, after many years, he gets to be king for 40 years. And David, of course, a wonderful man. He made no mistakes at all except for one little minor episode with Bathsheba, and oh yes, he killed Bathsheba's husband and a number of soldiers, and oh yeah, he had 10 wives and 17 sons, and oh, there was quite a few times he forgot to walk with God, and he walked in the flesh, and he wrote some pretty nice psalms, and we think very highly of him, but he was a pretty flawed person, like everybody. But he repented. He really came around. When God confronted him with his sin, he always came clean, and, which is really neat. Man after God's own heart. So he gets a place of high honor, highest honor. Model king. This is a model king. This is a man that's very much like Jesus is going to be like when Jesus comes as the perfect king. Except for these little minor things that David did. 40 years. David's son Solomon, born by Bathsheba, comes along. Solomon is the wisest man who ruled, a great man, a wonderful king, 40-year reign. How's he? Why? Oh, he ran off and married Pharaoh's daughter and built a palace for her and brought in all the foreign gods. And now he ended up with, six wives, was it?
No,
700. Some girlfriends on the side? 300. There's that little statement in there about the little understatement that says, and his wives caused his heart to turn away from the Lord to all the pagan gods, and then his kingdom went, but he was the wealthiest and the wisest man in the ancient world. So when he was behaving well, his kingdom was wonderful. He had David was a military, got a lot of military victories. They had peace for their enemies. And so there was a little season there, and Solomon built the temple and dedicated it, and God blessed it, and the Spirit of God came down and filled the temple with light, and there was rejoicing, and people came to see Solomon because he was so wise, and people came to wonder and marvel at Israel and the God of Israel for a little while. Then he got away from God. Wrote Song of Solomon, then he got away from God, and finally came back to God, and probably wrote Ecclesiastes at the end of his life and died. Now we get a fresh new start after the death of Solomon, don't we? Everything now, we're going to get that wonderful new king here. All these kings, they just emulate their wonderful godly fathers, don't they? Like father, like son. So what happens when Solomon dies? We've got two kings. Now we have a divided kingdom. We have a little family fight in which a military general by the name of Jeroboam comes in and pulls off a coup. And he gets away with that because the legitimate heir to the throne, Rehoboam, is a flake. What does he do? He's the legitimate heir to the throne. He ought to keep the country together, and he's just a young guy.
He increased taxes on the high taxes of Solomon even higher so he could have more wealth and power than he
did. He did. He cracked right down on the people who are already overtaxed, and he rejected the advice of the godly men in the country. I'm going to run things my own way. And that provoked this rebellion that split the kingdom in half. Now, the whole point about this, the whole point here is there's an accumulated history going on. There's a cumulative history of Israel going on here. Is it getting better and better, like we are? No, it's getting worse and worse. It's going downhill.
Like we are.
two questions. First, the role of the prophet. prophet. Now, when we have already got the word, do we still have someone? So, do we still need prophets in this?
This is a great question.
Second question is about judgment, and I think if we are saying this is judgment on Israel, then it's very sensitive, because I've heard other comments like people say, oh, we had 9/11 because we worship material too much, that's why that symbol was bombed or whatever. And I think those are very cruel things to say.
Oh, yes. Nobody's doing very well over there in the Middle East. Will God judge Israel? Yes, he will. Severely. Very, very severely. More severely than everybody else, yes. Higher standards, more knowledge, higher calling, more severe judgment. Will he judge the nations? Yes, he will judge the nations on the basis of how they've treated the Jews. That's pretty scary. If you hate the Jews, you're in big trouble. Will God judge everybody? Yes, he will. I started a long article on this last summer, and it got so long, I just gave up and put it on my website and abandoned it. It's very profitable then. Yeah.
His comment about Solomon being wise. From time to time, we're told that we should be praying for our leaders. And one of the things I pray for, whether it's George Bush or Arnold or whoever, is wisdom.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm praying for the wrong thing. what? Are the appropriate things to pray?
No, if you go back and look at the David's prayer when he became king, and if you look at Solomon's prayer when he became king, those are wonderful prayers. They're great. Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple, when he asked wisdom to govern the people, and he asked all the right things. And God was pleased with his prayers. So sometimes you get off to a good start and then you kind of forget what it was you prayed about. But now let's look here a little bit. Now what's so interesting is to read through Kings and Chronicles and look at all these men, all these kings, and see how they did. Because you're in that class. Our American presidents are in this, you know. The most bad. Look at the history of Israel, the 10 northern tribes. Look at the list of 19 kings. Bad, 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 bad. Not a single one of them paid any attention to God. Put God first in his life, prayed, asked for wise counsel, sought the will of the Lord. None of them. None. Zero.
Was Abijah, who was the first prophet under the northern kings, a different person than Abijah, the second king?
Yes, yes. Abijah, the Hebrew word means Yahweh is my father. The Ab is Abba, father, and Yah. So that's a very common name. But you look over in the right-hand column on your king's list, you look over there that when Israel began to get out of line and that God raised up prophets, and over on the list of the right side, we find Elijah and Elisha and Jonah and Amos and Hosea coming and speaking to the northern tribes. Not getting any obedience out of them, but being wonderful, marvelous prophets. And reading the story of Elijah and Elisha, just thrilling, wonderful parts of the Bible, great examples for us. And then these bad kings. During the time of the history of the northern kings, the main antagonist on the north was Syria, the nation of Syria. As this story winds on, the rising, ascending power in that region is Assyria, with headquarters over in Nineveh, which is today the Iraq city of Mosul. Right outside of Mosul is ancient Nineveh. So over the course of this time period, from about 910 down to 722, we have this transition in which the main military threat to the northern tribes is Syria and Damascus, right to the north, and then it moves over into Assyria. And we get up to the prophet Isaiah, and we find that the main threat to Israel is the great armies of Assyria. And Assyria was a cruel army, cruel and terrible in warfare. And we have God sent a man to speak to them, whose name was Jonah. Why was he reluctant to go speak to these ugly, awful, terrible Assyrians? Well, they're their hated enemies. They're cruel. And lo and behold, they repented. And lo and behold, God gave Nineveh another 150 years
I guess the analogous situation today, well, not exactly today, is if you've seen the Lord of the Rings movies, that would be like being sent as a missionary to the orcs. That would just be really...
like a missionary to the orcs. That's right. Yeah. They were orc-like. Yeah. But they repented, and God gave them another 150 years. And then the prophet Nahum comes along, and he says, it's time for Assyria to go. And so God announces judgment to the next generation of the Assyrians, because the time has come, and they get wiped out. They get wiped out by the power immediately to the south in Babylon, which is now the ascending power in the Middle East. Remember, the Assyrian armies came all the way down and besieged Jerusalem. Assyrian armies came and besieged Jerusalem in the time of Isaiah. Shortly after this, in 722, the Assyrians will in fact carry the 10 northern tribes into captivity. Remember what happened when the Assyrians came up to Jerusalem and sent their envoys, speaking in Hebrew, to taunt Hezekiah and Isaiah, who are inside the city, and sent a letter in saying, capitulate, all the other towns, you're doomed. And Isaiah took the letter, and he went into the temple with Hezekiah, and they prayed before the Lord, and they said, Lord, save the city. And God did, because it wasn't time for Jerusalem to fall. The 10 northern tribes had fallen, and it wasn't the Assyrians who were going to destroy Jerusalem. Now this takes you to the time of Isaiah. So you see the time of Isaiah. This is 150 or so years before the time of Ezekiel. A lot of really great stuff going on in the northern tribes and these changes in military power. Now, 722 comes along, and so the 10 northern tribes are taken off into captivity. Now we have only the two southern tribes left. And if you look on the left side of your king's chart, you'll see the history of those kings. 20 of them. And we see bad, bad, good, good. Bad, bad, bad. Good, 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 good. Bad, good, bad, 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 bad. A little different. Some good kings, yeah.
Does it mean that Joel and Isaiah and Micah were particularly good prophets, that they happen to be around when they were good kings?
It could. It could mean that.
Is that the reason why he just needs to lie 40 days
Yes, now the sins in the southern tribe, first of all, well, I think what we'll do, we've got a little time, I think what we'll do real quick to get you a summary, and I think is to go to 2 Kings 17 for an incredibly fine summary. What we'll do every week, we'll do little flashbacks to the history, so you'll see the setting of Ezekiel a little bit more clearly, and it won't seem so horrifying and out of context. 2 Kings 17 is a summary of the captivity of the 10 northern tribes under the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to come in and devastate the 10 northern tribes, with capital S Samaria. Okay, let me read this for you. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, that you find Ahaz on your chart down there, king number 12 in Judah, and Hoshea, the son of Elah, you find him as the last king in Israel. In the 12th year, Hoshea the son became king in Israel, and he reigned 9 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings were before him. We find Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. So the king of Assyria comes into the northern tribes, sort of takes over and demands heavy taxes. That's easier than taking over a country. And if you could just tax them, you don't have to manage the infrastructure. And if we could do that in Iraq, we wouldn't have sent our army there. Okay, the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, that Hoshea wasn't about to live up to the terms of this landlord-tenant agreement, because Hoshea had sent to So, king of Egypt. Egypt's still a major power at this time in history. And he brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he'd done year by year. So king of Assyria is not getting his taxes from the 10 northern tribes. So they take Hosea and throw him in prison. And the king of Assyria went through the land and up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years, capital city of Samaria. So the Assyrians come right in, depose the king, and take over. All right? In the 9th year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, and he carried Israel away to Assyria, and he placed them in Halah by Habor, the river Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. That down, it turns out the region of the Volga River. So he takes these 10 northern tribes, a few million people, gets them out of the land and scatters them. The so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now, summary, God's summary of this. So it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods. And they had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel which they had made. Also, the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. This is all the idolatrous shrines and temples, which would be probably football stadiums and shopping malls and movie theaters. And, well, I won't digress here. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images. This would be the Canaanite statues of immorality and idolatry and internet pornography and lewdness and all that stuff. There they burned incense on all the high places as the nations had done, as the Canaanites had done, whom the Lord drove out from before them, and they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger, compromised with the idolatry of the world about them. They served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this thing." The Lord testified against Israel and against Judah, southern tribes, by all of his prophets, namely every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets." Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. Father, son. They rejected his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters. They went after the nations, emulated the nations who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molten image and two calves, one at Bethel and one at Dan, and they made a wooden image, and they worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. That's astrology and divination and witchcraft and sorcery and syncretism. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire, killed their children, abortion, and so on, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, and they sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel, and he removed them from his sight. His sight being the land of Israel is the place he keeps his eye on so he can get out of my sight. Interesting picture here. Yeah, but he left the tribe of Judah alone and Benjamin. Also, Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel which they made. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them all from his sight. He tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat the king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord. The king turned the people away from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. Leaders do that. The children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said he would do by all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Now what did the king of Assyria do? He brought in foreigners from Babylon and Cutha and Ava and Hamath, and he put them in the land. So now he imports a whole bunch of foreigners into the land, and that doesn't work very well. Verse 25, "And so it was at the beginning when these foreigners came to live there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them." In other words, the land of Israel doesn't tolerate foreigners living there who bring their other gods with them. That's the God of Israel's land. It's just very interesting. So the people moving over there are saying, "We're having a hard time here, and we need a little help, so send some of those Jews back here and so that we can learn what the laws of the land are all about." And the king of Assyria sent in some of the priests, some of the Jewish priests, so they could learn the Jewish religion so that they could placate the God of Israel. And the Jews came in and placated the God of Israel by building temples and shrines And that settled things down a little bit, and we end up with a group of people that are living in the northern land that are kind of half-breeds and syncretistic in their religion because they keep their own religion, but they also add in the God of Israel. Who are the people that came in? The Samaritans. This is where the Samaritans came from. And to this very day, there are Samaritans that were practicing their religion up there, not fair, they're not evil. This amalgamated religion, this is a common human problem. So the northern part of Israel has very few Jews living in it. It has mostly foreigners that are settling in there. They brought their own gods. They mixed the God of Israel in with their own religious system. You see that going on in the world today? A little bit of Christianity, a little bit of Islam, a little Buddhism, a little goodwill, a little Unitarianism, a little get one world. We've all got to get along with one another and be tolerant. You can see that. Except it's very special in the land of Israel. Of verse 41. So these nations feared the Lord, the Samaritans, yet they served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did even to this day. Now that's the setting for the gospel. When Jesus comes down to Samaria and leads the woman at the well to know himself, you see this mercy and compassion coming to the Samaritans who are more ready to believe in Jesus than the Jews. And the story of the Good Samaritan, these people that were looked down on by their fellow Jews, and they ended up being more ready to become believers when Jesus came than most of the Jews. But that's the setting. See the setting here? And this is in Isaiah's day, and so God said, this is the way it is, folks.
Do you think you could sum it up sort of like they just didn't pay a whole lot of attention to God anymore? Because the glaring inconsistency with that syncretistic.
Yes, a little bit of religion, a little like Christianity.
Well, that would then create what we have today, the moral assuredness and the self-righteousness that goes along with practices that traditionally we know are just downright evil.
Yeah.
But we call them good.
Yep.
We call them bad good.
In Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters. Either he hates one or loves the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
Next week we'll do the next two chapters, and we'll get into more of this background. See how this background kind of helps, how people get to this place. It isn't overnight. It's over a long period of time. You see that God wanting to correct it and fix it as he does with us. Our Father, thank you for this very sobering time in the book of Ezekiel. It's shocking. It's alarming. It's not what we're used to hearing, because we like to hear good news. We like to think that we're doing really well, that everything's fine, but really we know that it's not fine. In the country, we may be individually doing all right, but the nation isn't. The church as a whole isn't. We are compromised and in need of awakening and cleansing and separating and getting a fresh look at ourselves from you. We all kind of need Ezekiel's vision to see ourselves as we are and see where we are in history, see things the way you see them, because history is moving forward at a great pace. It's more comfortable to be on the sidelines as spectators. You called all of us to the work of the ministry. There are not very many Christians in the world. We are a little remnant, and we need to listen to you. So give us hearts willing to believe and to grow and to learn and to listen. We know above all that you're a God of incredible mercy, that you long to heal and restore and fulfill, and that's your whole purpose, that you only reluctantly judge and only as a last resort. So we do pray your mercy on the church in America, and we pray your mercy on this land, and we would pray that you might grant a great awakening, a grassroots awakening that brings again holiness and godliness among your people, and that your light would burn brighter and brighter in our midst until the darkness is dispelled. Thanks for the exciting time in history, and thanks for the record of your workings in history that we can look and see how it is that you interact with people, the stories of these men and women who've gone before us. And thanks, Lord, for being with us and the freedom we have to serve you and worship you. In the name of Jesus. Lots of notes. Pass notes over there. Thank you.